Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at UAA's 5th Annual Constitution Day Polaris Lecture, where Anchorage attorney Doug Pope is addressing the 49th State Fellows. His talk on why the Constitution is important to you was recorded on Thursday, September 17th, at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
If I could have your attention, please. I'd like to welcome everyone to UAA's annual Constitution Day Polaris Lecture with a special welcome to all the high school students in the audience. My name is Christine Yeager, and I'm one of the 49th State Fellows. This is a program under the Honors College here at UAA and helps to sponsor events like tonight's Polaris Lecture. The Fellows program is designed for students with a desire to become Alaska's future leaders. The Fellows have a wide variety of focuses. For example, I'm studying the natural sciences. But the program helps us to get a good foundation in subjects such as history, economics, political philosophy, and other areas that really help to help us to figure out, you know, what's causing events that happen in the modern world, things that happened before, that sort of thing. And the program also provides us with really good opportunities to meet influential members of society on national, state, and local levels. We also get mentorships with local leaders. So with that, I would like to introduce our program director, Professor Stephen Haycox.
Thanks very much.
Some years ago, when the Congress was entertaining education reform, Senator Robert Byrd, the now senior senator, introduced legislation that any educational institution in the United States that receives federal funding must undertake some effort to recognize the United States Constitution, some curricular effort, on Constitution Day, the day of the ratification of the current Constitution in Philadelphia in September of 1787. That fit very nicely with the Polaris lectures because we have a series of lectures, as you know, and so it was very convenient for us to take advantage of that since the focus of the 49th State Fellows program is history and political philosophy, and particularly bringing our students to an understanding of the significance of the founding of the American Democratic Republic and how it functions and how it manifests ancient values about government and society. So it's particularly a delight this evening to have our 5th annual Constitution Day Polaris Lecture in Doug Pope. Doug is an Alaskan, graduated from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, earned his law degree at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. Doug is a lawyer's lawyer in this sense. Not only does he know the law and practice it well, but in addition to that, he has never forgotten the purpose of law, which is to seek justice. And in all of the work that he has done, that caring, that compassion, that social conscience has manifested itself. In addition to that, Doug and his family have followed his parents and decided to stay in Alaska and be Alaskans. Not everybody does that. Doug has achieved a sterling reputation in Anchorage and statewide as a compassionate and effective attorney and somebody who really does understand and care about the Constitution. So it's just a delight to have him here this evening. Please join me in welcoming Doug Pope.
Thank you, Steve. You're way too kind. My name is Doug Pope, and the title of this lecture is Why the Constitution is Important to You. I'm a trial lawyer, and that... Let me explain what that means, at least in my understanding, is that I try to really understand the law and then help my clients, help apply the law in my client's situation. I'm not what I would call a cause lawyer. I don't work for any one client. I don't work for any particular philosophy. What I do is I look at the problems my clients bring to me, and I think, can I help this person or can someone else do it better? And if I think I can help them, I try to. And that's led me over the years into a number of constitutional cases. And I never imagined that I would get involved in constitutional law. It really never entered my mind. I was just a kid in Fairbanks going to college, trying to figure out which classes I could get A's in so I could get out. And this friend said to me that he was going to law school. And I thought, what? If he can go to law school, I can go to law school. And that's the real truth of how I ended up going to law school. I didn't develop a passion. In fact, when I was your age, I knew nothing about the law, nothing other than that there was a lawyer in Fairbanks who could get you off if you had a parking ticket or a traffic ticket. So I ended up going to law school and then just start getting involved in different cases. And so I'm not a state or national leader, and I'm not a visiting scholar. I'm just a trial lawyer who has had some experience. And I thought maybe I could enlist you to consider what social changes have occurred in this country because young people, like all of you, and the young at heart too, have occurred when young people and the young at heart have challenged the institutional authority, the conventional wisdom, the status quo. You know what I'm talking about because you all encounter it every day, just about. I'm part of the status quo, I would say. The conventional wisdom is, I'm sure you've heard it ringing in your ears many times. But over history, I think, and especially in this country, there's been social advancement when young people and the young at heart have decided, you know, that just doesn't make sense to me. And I want to do something about it, or I want to say something about it. And I guess I would challenge you, if you are really here and you're really interested in the Constitution, to think about that, because you're entering those years when the opportunities for doing so are going to start happening, if they already haven't happened yet. So one of the questions I have, though, for the 49 State Fellows Program is, how many of you ever had a class where the Constitution of the United States or of the state of Alaska was actually studied? Well, good. That's good to hear, because my impression is a lot of people have no idea what the Constitution really means, and I certainly didn't when I was your age. So maybe I'm going to be repeating some things that you already know, but I want to provide a little background before we get into the real meat of the lecture. The U.S. Constitution was adopted in 1787, as Professor Haycock said. Everybody's seen a version of this. We the People, this is the sort of the first page of it. It goes on for a number of articles. And the first three articles deal with what's called the separation of powers. There's been a model for governance that goes back to the Greeks that is based upon the division of branches of government. And the normal the Romans really put it to use. They didn't have a constitution. But it was in the common law of Rome, the sort of the traditions of Rome. There were three branches of government during the Republic. When Caesar took over, that all changed. Then there was only one branch, and that was him. But the normal division is into executive, legislative, and judicial branches. And the first three articles of the United States Constitution vest the legislative power in the Congress, the executive power in the President, and the judicial power in one Supreme Court. Well, why is that important? The only reason that's important here is because the one Supreme Court gets to decide what the law is. And that's where I come in. Because I practice in the judicial branch of government. It's my job to convince the court that what the law is and for the court to pronounce that. So the real-life situations that I want to take you through here, not all of them, but most of them, I think, no, all of them involve instances where the judge, the court, had to declare what the law was in a particular situation and had to determine whether the government had the right to do what it wanted to do or the rights of the citizen should instead be honored. So that was the Constitution, but then people started saying, well, wait a minute, there's nothing, there's all this stuff about presidents and Congress and judges, but what about us? So that led to the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights was passed 4 years later. And the first 10 amendments of the Constitution and passed by the Senate and the House and then voted on by the people, and they were ratified in 1791. So 4 years after the Constitution was adopted, the Bill of Rights was ratified. At the time, the most important amendments that we're going to talk about here today that were adopted were the First Amendment, which prohibited, for what we're going to talk about today, prohibiting the free exercise of a religion. That's in the First Amendment. Abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people to assemble. The First Amendment bars that. The Sixth Amendment gives every person a right to a speedy and public trial. And this latter amendment is one that citizens have exercised frequently, going all the way back to the time of the ratification of the Constitution, to challenge authority. They've defied the government to in a government ban and challenged the government to arrest them and put them on trial. So, but there was a problem with the Constitution, and that was black people were allowed to be held in slavery, and women were not allowed to vote. And so the Constitution provided equal rights for white males, but not for anybody else. And the other part of the problem with the Constitution was that it only applied to the federal government. It didn't apply to the states. So the states were free to do whatever they wanted, basically. And this prevailed for 75 years. So what happened, you history majors? The Civil War. The which there's a lot that you can say about the Civil War, but most people would would agree now that it was fought over slavery, and that there historically during the Civil War, we know that Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and then there was a event that happened that some historians look back at now and declare to be a watershed in the nation's history. And who can tell me what that is? The Gettysburg Address. Lincoln at Gettysburg. So Lincoln didn't, I don't think he really planned it but this way, but it turns out that the Gettysburg Address was a pivotal moment and perhaps even a cause of action for the country. And it was a simple address. You've all heard it. Here's his handwriting on the first page. And we've all heard the government of the people, by the people, that part. But what some scholars are looking at now is the part right before that. That states that this nation shall have a new birth of freedom. And a lot of people now look back and think that that was a call to the greater good of the country and that it resonated. And that was on November 19th of 1863. Well, what followed was, as you know, the war ended. And then Congress took up Lincoln's call for a new birth of freedom. And the Congress passed what was called the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And that amendment was very simply stated, Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So every person was a citizen. No state shall make or enforce any law that shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. What this amendment did was change the entire nature of the relationship between the federal and the state governments. No longer could the states do anything that they wanted. They had to abide by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which laid out the rights that I just read to you. Over time, the Supreme Court has interpreted that section as meaning that all of the Bill of Rights have been now incorporated into the meaning of the 14th Amendment. And so whereas in prior to that time, states could, for example, abridge free speech and not violate the U.S. Constitution, afterwards they couldn't. And so the U.S. Supreme Court finally started taking up cases about individuals who were challenging the authority of various state and local governments because they didn't like what was happening. And I think there's some lessons in these cases for you, because I think it is reasonable for you to ask at this point, well, you know, why is this important to me? And I say that you are the new generation encountering the older generation as young adults. And since we represent the status quo, the establishment, the conventional wisdom, that it's important that you understand that people have been successful in challenging that in the past. And that some people have paid a price, but we'll talk about that too. So, besides, your generation will at some time become the establishment, and a new generation will challenge your status quo. And that's as it should be. And so I think it's worth looking forward now to try to understand how life might unfold. So let's look at some real-life situations. So who recognizes this person? Susan B. Anthony. Susan B. Anthony, a lot of people, she's also, some people might recognize her because she's on the coin, the dollar coin, the ones with the little the multi-edges. She was a remarkable woman who looked at the 14th Amendment and said, well, yeah, look at this part where it says that everybody is a citizen of the United States and that everyone has the same privileges and immunities. Well, why can't I vote if that's the case? So she decided to do something about it. And what she did was she went to this was in a small town, where you went to register for your vote was the barber shop, so a guy's place, right? And there's three big guys in there who you have to register with. So you can imagine her, the long dress of the time, walking through a muddy street, walking up with a couple of friends and saying, I demand to be registered, because I have a right to under the 14th Amendment. And these men who had never seen anything like this before had to go in the back room for a while. And some accounts are that it took an hour to figure out what to do. And finally, the supervisor said, well, let her register. Then it's on her. And he knew what he was doing, because it wasn't a crime to register her, but it was a crime to allow her to vote. But she was registered, and so were some of her friends. And so the sort of the word spread that Susan B. Anthony was going to try to vote. So there was actually a crowd at the polling place. And this is just a couple of years after the adoption of the 14th Amendment. So we're talking less than 10 years after the Civil War. So she shows up, and there's a bunch more consternation. And finally, they allow her to drop a ballot in the ballot box. The next day, the local newspaper, which I can't remember the city, but it's more than just a small town, ran an editorial that said that she should be put in jail because she had no right to vote. Somebody complained, and she was charged with a crime. So which one of her rights was important here? The right to a public trial, which she demanded. And so she was tried. And the whole case was tried over that she reasonably believed that she had the right to vote and she couldn't be prosecuted criminally when she did not intend to break the law. And the judge wasn't very sympathetic because he was part of what? The status quo. He applied the conventional wisdom, which was that women are really not equal with white males, and so there's a good reason why they can't vote. They might, I'm not sure what they might do, but whatever it was the conventional wisdom of the time. The judge gave her a sentence, which was a fine, and she defied him, and she refused to pay it right in the court. It's right there in the court. You can read the transcript of it. And he realized that if he put her in jail, that she would have a right to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say that the 14th Amendment, and argue her case to the directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. So he refused to put her in jail, and she refused to pay the fine, and that was and that's where the case ended. But the and it was probably another quite a few years until the 19th Amendment was adopted that gave women the right to vote. But the reason that came then was because Susan B. Anthony challenged the status quo and demanded the right to vote. And history, if you look back in history now, I can't imagine not allowing somebody to vote. And I would imagine most of you probably feel the same way. So the wisdom has changed. And the law has changed because Susan B. Anthony challenged it. Going into this century, let's bring this guy, little guy's face up here. This is Walter Gobitis. He's a he's on the left there, little toe-headed guy, probably 12 years old, and he his parents were Jehovah's Witness. And in the 1930s, now we've all done the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Everybody knows that part. Okay. But not very many people know that it used to be that you had to salute while you were reading the Pledge of Allegiance. And this is what the salute looked like. I wish I could really blow this up, you know. I mean, I can't. You know, when you first look at it, you go, what were they thinking? This is the 1930s. I mean, Nazis were already arming for the Second World War. The Reichstag was marching in the streets, you know. Hitler had already burned the Bundestag or whatever it was. And in this country, every day the children go to school, and at the beginning, they're not only required to recite the, but also to salute. And so, Walter Gobitis' parents didn't like that. They were Jehovah's Witnesses, and they thought that. That was sort of doing something that the Ten Commandments specifically didn't allow or forbade. And so they brought a case. And it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, ultimately. And the school district justified it on the basis that it fostered national unity, to have all these students saluting the flag like that. And the Supreme Court decided the case that it, and because Walter Gobitis had refused to salute and he'd been expelled from school. And so his parents brought a case, and he went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, it's okay. And people were outraged in the country. And the judge who wrote the opinion said, I understand that people are worried about trying to get everybody to get into lockstep in line, but the fact of the matter is the state needs to foster unity, and it's the responsibility of every citizen to see that that's done, so it doesn't violate the First Amendment. It doesn't bridge exercise of religion. So, the case, as I said, people were outraged, and there was a lot of discussion around the country. And so 4 years later, there's a young man and sister, a young man in Pennsylvania who is required to, and he refuses to do so, and he's expelled, and his father his father's charged with a crime. So in any event, the same thing happened again. But this time, the case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this time, the Supreme Court changed its mind. And the court reversed the suspension. And so why did that happen? 4 years later, same issue. Who can think of a reason? Three new justices on the United States Supreme Court. Plus, two of them changed their minds. There was such an outcry in the country about it that it triggered this dialogue all through the country, in schools and universities, at government levels. Franklin Roosevelt even invited Walter Gubaitis to the White House. And so, I don't know if any of you used to watch. There was this great cartoon when I was a kid called Pogo, this comic strip. And one of the smartest things Pogo ever said is that the judges read the election returns. And that was certainly true in that case, but it established that there's a liberty component to the to the 14th Amendment, and that the liberty of citizens includes the right to defy authority, the right to say, no, I am not going to pay homage to your ideology or your orthodoxy or your conventional wisdom. And so now you still see students doing the Pledge of Allegiance, but no longer they're giving the Nazi salute. And incidentally, I don't say that flippantly, because in the second case that went up, there was a huge controversy before the school board. Now, this is like 1939 there was a huge controversy before the school board that they didn't want their children doing that because it looked like a Nazi salute. And if you get into if you read the details of the case, there's this long footnote where the justices talk about whether it was, in fact, a Nazi salute. And there's the stuff about the being back here as opposed to up here, and I didn't quite understand it all. But that looks pretty close to me. But the school board overruled the objections of the parents at the time that this was inappropriate because it looked like you were endorsing the Nazi dogma. Here's another one. I love this one. This is the Loving case. And Richard and Mildred Loving. And as you can see, he's white and she's black. And this case has happened after the Second World War. They were a happily married couple, beautiful children, involved in the community. And the police came into their house in the evening and arrested them because there was a law that made it a crime for a white man to marry a black woman, or a black woman to marry a white man.
Where was that?
Virginia. And the state of Virginia defended the law. Well, first they said, well, it really doesn't discriminate against black people, because if you're a white person marrying a black person, you get charged with a crime too. And that argument didn't go very far. But the more serious argument that they tried to advance, and which the court rejected, was that that the mongrelization of the culture was a bad thing. That it wasn't good to have people who are half black and half white, because it would lead to various impurities in the races, and that the state of Virginia had the right to say, we don't want mongrels in our state. I mean, that's sort of a harsh way of characterizing their argument. But they put on evidence to try to prove this. They put on evidence to try to prove that people who, products of mixed marriages, had these problems that other children didn't have. And the Supreme Court didn't buy it. And they declared in Loving v. Virginia that the 14th Amendment absolutely precluded the government from telling somebody who they could marry. And so they decided it on a much broader notion than just white or black. They just said the government just does not have any business in this at all. And it would have been easy, and they later talked about it, it would have been easy for them. They could have just sort of quietly entered into a plea deal, and it wouldn't have taken 5 years out of their lives and whatever else it cost them to stand up for what they believed. But they didn't do that. They instead chose to stand and defy the conventional wisdom. They defied the law, and they defied the conventional wisdom, which was that mixed races have no business in American society. What's the lesson there? I think the lesson is that you can pay a heavy price for challenging authority. But would anybody, I mean, how many people now find it kind of odd that the state would even make it a crime that a black woman couldn't marry a white man? I mean, I find it odd. And so what that means is that the conventional wisdom has changed. And it's because of Richard and Mildred Loving. Here's... this is a nice couple, too. They look kind of nerdy, don't they? This is John and Mary Beth Tinker. And they, I think, deserve a special place in all this. They were high school students during the Vietnam War in Iowa. And they... like a lot of people then, there was a lot of discussion about the war. And they, though, lived in like the Des Moines, Iowa, which is about as middle of the country as you can get. And where there was a lot of conventional wisdom. So a group of students met at the home, one of their homes in Des Moines, in December of 1965, and to make plans to wear armbands to school, to silently wear armbands to school to announce their opposition to the Vietnam War. The principals kind of got the word about this, and so They adopted a verbal policy immediately. I love that part, you know, a verbal policy. Anybody wearing armbands would be asked to remove them, and if they refused, they would be suspended until they were willing to return without armbands. The word kind of went out. I mean, there was a lot of talk. This is in Des Moines, and most of the students decided, I don't really think so. I think I'll just, it might threaten my chances for getting into college, might threaten my chances for a scholarship, so I think I'll let this pass by me. Mary Beth and her brother, John, did not do that. And he went to high school, she went to junior high, different schools. They wore the black armbands. When John entered the school, there he was exposed to threats in the hallway. The captain of the football team attempted to rip off the armband. He then turned himself into the principal's office for protection, where the vice principal and asked him if he wanted a busted nose. Now, what I remember about vice principals is they were sort of the heavy guys, you know, the people who were the enforcement guys. Watch out for him because he's a little mean. And this is the way this guy sounded. So the vice principal told him that the seniors didn't like the armband, and so the vice principal called his mother and asked him to order John to take it off. And she refused. And then he called in the school counselor, and the counselor told him if he wanted to go to college, he'd better change his mind because colleges didn't accept protesters. And but they refused, and they were suspended from school and not allowed to return. And so they contacted a trial lawyer who brought a case against the school board under the 14th Amendment. And the result was, this was a watershed case for student rights. The U.S. Supreme Court the Chief Justice that authored the opinion, there's a famous quote that students do not sort of give up their constitutional rights when they walk through the schoolhouse door. And it was not a unanimous decision. It was a 6-3 vote. And the dissenting justice claimed that it was going to open the door to all sorts of sort of downgrading of public mores. And maybe he was right. I don't think so. But they certainly were intimidated. Their parents were intimidated. They thought they were doing the right thing, and the Supreme Court agreed that under the 14th Amendment, which incorporated the First Amendment, that they had a right to do that as long as they were not causing a disturbance, and they weren't. Now, you might think that, that was in Iowa. That couldn't happen here. This happened when I was in Fairbanks. I grew up in Fairbanks. And there's a young man named Russell Breeze who was in high school at the time at Actually, he was in junior high at the time. The old Maine school in Fairbanks. And the principal and the superintendent thought that his hair was too long. And I wish I had a picture of him, but I couldn't find one. I actually even tried to find a picture of myself in that year because I had long hair at one time, too. But in any event, he was expelled because he refused to have his hair cut. And it was like, I mean, there was all kinds of testimony in the court. It didn't come down below the shoulders. It was totally well-groomed hair. But the powers that be in Fairbanks, the conventional wisdom, had decided that it was a sign of sort of rebellion, of challenging authority, and that it would only encourage people to, other students, to challenge authority if we allowed somebody to go to school with long hair. So he was expelled. And it ended up in court, and two of the best trial lawyers in Fairbanks were on opposite sides. Steve Cooper, who went on to be a governor of the state, is a great trial lawyer. He represented Russell Breeze. And Charlie Cole, who went on to become attorney general under Governor Hickel, defended the school district. And I just would like to read to you the court's recitation of the evidence that the school district put in. Smith, who was the superintendent of schools, testified that his primary objection to long hair being worn by male students was that it was a deviation from the norm of appearances and caused distractions and disruptions within the school system. He further testified that he believed that good grooming improves personal behavior, and that the student with long hair has a poor self-image and consequently his personal behavior is not what it could be, that the long-haired student is negative, defensive, and in trouble, and there's a very direct relationship between personal appearance and behavior. That Breeze put on evidence in his behalf, but that was what I just read to you was sort of the conventional wisdom at the time. That was certainly true. I went to law school. There was 200 men there who all had really short hair, and about three people with long hair, and it was not something that was sort of in the mainstream. It later did come into the mainstream, but Breeze, the Supreme Court looked at the case, the Alaska Supreme Court, as another case where the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment was the guidance that they would look at. They actually decided it under state constitutional grounds, but they looked at the 14th Amendment to determine that Russell Breeze had an absolute constitutional right to wear his hair that length and he could not be expelled from school. This is another example where there's sort of a federal and a state version of the same story. In 1923, a teacher in Nebraska was arrested for teaching German in the classroom. That, which is kind of a, you think, oh, what were they doing? What were they thinking? German in the classroom? And there was, at the time, the First World War had been fought. People were mad at the Germans. We don't want any crowds here, that kind of thing. But there was also another element of it, and that was that they only wanted people to speak in English, because if people weren't speaking in English, they really didn't know what was going on, and they didn't want that to happen. And so they passed this law, and it was that made it a crime, particularly, and they could get away with it on German. I don't know if they'd, been Norwegian, they probably wouldn't have been able to get away with it. But so this teacher was arrested for teaching German sort of offhand to one of his students. And he was convicted in a trial. The Supreme Court of Nebraska said, yeah, that's okay. And the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the case and they said, you know, we think the 14th Amendment has an impact here, and so does the First Amendment. And the fact that this person's teaching German isn't threatening anyone, or there's no evidence that the powers that be, again, put on evidence, oh, if you're speaking German in the school, you can't be trusted, you know, there's reasons why it's a bad thing. But the U.S. Supreme Court didn't agree with that, and they found that the convicting this teacher of a crime was a violation of the 14th Amendment. Well, he had been offered, the teacher, Robert Meyer, had been offered sort of another kind of a quiet deal, you know, just pay a few dollar fine and, you know, it'll all go away, and he refused to do that. Instead, he stood on his rights under the 14th Amendment. Well, you think, yeah, that was 1923, you know, that could never happen now. Well, I wish I had a photo of this guy. I want to tell you about a guy named Moses Kritz. He's a big, barrel-chested Yupik Eskimo from Togiak. And really a nice guy, as sweet a guy as you could ever, ever meet. And he was the mayor of the city of Togiak. And in 1998, there was a citizens' initiative in this state, and the intention of the initiative was to require every public official and every person dealing with the public official speak in English. And at the time, I saw, you know, the petitions going around. I think, oh, I don't think that's a good idea. I even had friends. I thought, do you think this is a good idea, this petition? They, oh, yeah. They said, yeah, every time you try to call DMV, you get somebody who's talking Spanish. You don't know what they're saying. And I'm going, yeah, but, you know, this is different. So, but the 80% of the voters voted for the initiative. 80%. Moses Kritz, this whole little tiny city government that he had, that he was running, which was Moses and a finance person and somebody that ran the garage and a couple other people, they all talked in Yupik. And so that initiative made it illegal for Moses to talk to the people of his community when he was acting as mayor. And, excuse me. I remember him saying, and actually, let me digress for a minute. How many of you have ever, has anybody from here ever been to Togiak? One person. There's two. There's Fran. Fran's been to Togiak. Well, Togiak is an Eskimo village in western Alaska. It's on the sea, surrounded by tundra-covered hills. It can be a brutal place. I can remember being there in April when it was like 20 below and blowing, and there's frequently it's difficult to get in there until late May because of all the ice. But Togiak was also a convenient place in sort of the historic comings and goings of all the various explorers. And so Togiak has had people coming through it since Russian time. You know, there was the Russians and the British and the Americans, and the Americans decided to stay. And but there was a lot of people, people going into the interior of Alaska, people coming back out, and the Eskimo people in Togiak welcomed them all. And Moses' whole way of looking at this initiative was, well, wait a minute. We have sort of opened ourselves up to the community, to Alaska. We treat you with dignity when you come here. We believe that we all have a right to exist as cultures, and you're telling me I have to speak in your language? And so I said, yeah, I like that idea. So anyway, we brought a case. And eventually it was finally decided by the Alaska Supreme Court after a very long time that it was a violation of the First Amendment, that people have a right to speak the language that they feel most comfortable speaking in, and that doesn't mean that they have that we have to provide any particular services to them, but it does mean that we can't make it against the law for them to speak. And this took a long time because there was this big organization from the states that got involved, and it was called U.S. English. And it was their stated goal to bring these kind of laws all throughout the country. And so when the case was brought, it wasn't just against the state. The U.S. English got involved, and they had a lot of money, and they had a lot of lawyers, and so it was a hard-fought case. And it actually went to the Supreme Court twice. Once, first time on a procedural question, we moved to exclude U.S. English because we said they didn't have any standing in the case. What business is of it theirs? You know, why are they even here, Your Honor? They're not the state, and they're not the they're not an injured party. They're the people who are trying to propound this initiative. And the Supreme Court said, well, yeah, we're not going to let them participate, but their local affiliate chapter, which was called Alaskans for a Common Language, will let them participate. So as a result, that whole process took 8 years. Went up twice. It was argued twice. First time on that procedural question, second time on whether it violated the First Amendment. And then finally prevailed. So the lesson there, and that's what I wanted to sort of close with, is that there's going to be a lot of back pressure, you know, for anybody who does try to sort of challenge the status quo or even question the status quo. You can almost expect that. And because the status quo does not like to sort of yield ground readily. And I think that case, which is now in the books called Critz versus Alaskans for a Common Language, that case exemplifies the commitment that Moses Critz made. 8 years he had to stay with that case because he was convinced that that they had treated white people equally, and they weren't being treated that way. But he didn't want to make it about natives and whites. He wanted to make it about the First Amendment. And I wish I could show him here because he's got a big, broad smile. And I tried to find a picture of him with that big smile, but I couldn't. So I think I'll close my remarks. I don't know how long I've been at it. And if there's any questions, I'll be happy to take questions. But essentially, go out there and do what you want to do and challenge the status quo, if that's what you want to do.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA. This week, you heard Anchorage attorney Doug Pope addressing the 49th State Fellows at the University of Alaska Anchorage. His talk on why the Constitution is important to you was recorded on Thursday, September 17th, as part of UAA's 5th Annual Constitution Day Polaris Lecture. Audio for this week's edition of Addressing Alaskans was provided by Jeff Oliver at UAA. You can download today's program on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.